Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is Travis Hornsby, and today we're going to be talking about something a little dangerous, but I think reasonable to talk about now. First of all, we're going to talk about a reader question that I got about declining insurance company reimbursement rates for healthcare professionals. This is something that I think is going to hit close to home for a lot of you. So I actually spent a lot more time answering this question than I would usually do from a reader or listener, because I think it's a really fascinating series of questions. And the main part of the show, I'm actually going to talk about what President Trump's finances reveal about how you can manage your student loans in a better way. So I figured this would be a reasonable topic to discuss post-election so that we can kind of not look at this purely from a political lens. Obviously, the election's decided. We have most of all the results waiting on a few House races in the Georgia Senate runoff, which will determine a lot based off of what's going to happen with the Senate, meaning it's going to really influence things legislatively. I think there's some really interesting stuff in the New York Times that they reported on with Trump's finances that actually kind of reveal a lot about how you can maybe manage your student loans in a better, more efficient way. So we're going to cover some of that too in today's show. I wanted to start off with a really fascinating question I got from one of our clients. This is just really a great question on so many levels, because I think it really reflects a lot of the stress out there that healthcare professionals are dealing with their incomes and just with the pandemic and everything. So I'm going to call this a question from Anonymous. She says that in January, Medicare is potentially going to be cutting reimbursement rates for a lot of allied health services and possibly increasing the reimbursement for some types of physician office visits. She's basically calling out that there might be a 9% reimbursement cut for PT, occupational therapy, speech therapy, et cetera. And she's asking, basically, how do you deal with this when you've got student loan debt already greatly outweighing entry-level salaries and many even experienced salary levels for these healthcare professionals? And she says that healthcare companies, other orgs in the area are trying to pay physical therapists less because of upcoming cuts. Even if legislation succeeds in holding these cuts off, it sounds like cuts are inevitable later down the line. Many private insurance companies are expecting to use these Medicare guidelines to determine their own rates. Therefore, Medicare decreasing reimbursement will probably lead to other insurance companies decreasing reimbursement. I'll go through each one of her questions. So she says, first of all, how do we deal with eventual inflation in our salaries? What if our expectations that our salaries are going to be gradually increased over time actually lead to lower salaries instead? Because this 9% decrease in reimbursement rates presumably would show up in lower pay for physical therapists. So how do you deal with that when you have all this student loan debt? The thing is if you model inflation, generally speaking, that inflation is going to be 3% a year is the long-term historical average. So a lot of times people say, well, my salary's not going to change. Well, it will change probably. Most likely, it will go up with the level of inflation approximately. 1% to 2%, a lot of times we model that in our consults. And the thing is this, if your income for whatever reason goes down because of something like a cut in reimbursement rates from insurance companies, that makes forgiveness look even better. Think about that. If your pay goes down, then 10% of your income will be less money. So if 10% of your income is less money, then that means that you will pay less for your student loans, and the burden of your student loans is actually even less than it already was. Now, yes, you might have to save a little bit more for the tax bomb. That's probably not that big of a deal, because I think most likely the tax bomb is not going to exist anyway. Just that's reality. You're not going to have to probably pay, income taxes on your massive forgiven student loan debt just because it's probably not going to end up being collectible. Now, again, you can easily save for that. $500 to $1,000 a month in a brokerage account almost always covers the future tax bomb liability. But that's just something that I would just say, if forgiveness is already showing up as the right plan for you, then I would say if you're thinking that if you're worried about reimbursement cuts or insurance paying even less for procedures, then forgiveness is going to be even better in that world. So if your goal is to live in a specific area of the country where being a physical therapist or occupational therapist or speech language pathologist or whatever you are, and that pay for your occupation isn't particularly what you want it to be in that part of the country, but you don't want to move, then forgiveness allows you to stay in that part of the country, which is really great. Because even if they cut your pay as a physical therapist, you're still going to make a lot more than you would make as a working class person. You'll probably still make more than you would make with just a college degree in most cases. And you're going to have a lot more job security, hopefully a lot more activity level. You hopefully enjoy your job more than if you were sitting behind a computer doing random reports, right, that just don't really get you excited to wake up every day. But obviously, there's always the shoulda, woulda, coulda. Oh man, if I'd only become a fill in the blank, things would be so much better. Remember, if you wanted to do that, you do have the power to do that. You could go back to medical school. You could go back to nurse practitioner school if you really wanted to, because you're convinced that your current profession is not a great trajectory anymore. You can do that because 10% of your income is 10% of your income, regardless of how much you owe. And there's currently zero limits on how much you can borrow, which may or may not change in the next few years, right? So if you were concerned, you could always do that. Now, another question this listener asks, as a business owner, how do you deal with increased overhead costs going up every year? Meanwhile, while insurance companies are paying less per patient, how do you deal with that? And what's happening is you have certain areas of the country where there's a vast surplus of healthcare practitioners. Generally speaking, these are desirable areas to live, places where people really enjoy the city environment, the amenities, the cultural opportunities. They enjoy being around other young professionals. The housing market is very expensive because people really want to live there. And then if you go to a different area of the country there's not nearly as many people, that's a lot less of a sought after environment. And so you have a lot less competition. So here's some thoughts about what happens when you have an excess supply of labor in a place that's highly competitive. What happens is you have consolidation and you have a couple big companies that start leading the market share and dominating the market share. And then they start to push down costs because of their power in the marketplace. And they're able to sort of act almost monopolistically. What do you see in a lot of these parts of the country where there's, you know, a lot of competition, a little bit of an excess supply of labor? You see places like Heartland Dental taking over. You see different DSO groups for dental corporate offices. They just really dominate the area. There's PT groups, right? They're massive PT employers, and they sort of take over an area because they can now negotiate at a large scale with the insurance companies. They can push their reimbursement rates up for private insurers because they have more market power. In terms of Medicare and Medicaid, they might be price takers, right? But at least on the cost side of things, when insurance pays less and less, you have no choice but to try to control costs. So maybe they will pay their PTs less. And the thing is if there's a surplus of physical therapists in an area, they can afford to do that because there's too many physical therapists competing for too few jobs. Right. So then they have the ability to push down wages because they can. So really, if you kind of look at this stuff, the rates the government sets are somewhat arbitrary and very complicated bureaucratic political process that goes into determining what they're going to pay. And once that happens, market participants respond. So I would say this, if you're a business owner, one of the best ways to make more money or to have an easier situation for yourself is to relocate to an area that either has better reimbursement or better costs so you can have easier path to profitability. I call this the margin of success. How big is your margin of success? So if you're going to work in, I'm just going to pick a random example. I'm not sure if this area is super oversaturated or not, but Northern New Jersey, let's say, right? And you're competing with big corporate groups and you're trying to do it as a solo person. Your power for getting high payouts from insurance is going to be very minimal because if you don't want to take certain insurance companies, then people can just go down to the PT down the street. And then so your reimbursement there is at risk. So you feel like you have to sign up for every insurance company plan in the book, regardless of what they pay you. You have to feel like you even have to take all the Medicare and Medicaid patients that come in because of what you don't have a choice because there's so much competition. You need every dollar of revenue that you can possibly get. And then the other flip side to that problem is because it's a sought after area that people like to live in, then the rents are higher. The wages you have to pay workers because of their availability of other opportunities are much higher. So you have this problem where revenues are lower because of the competition and the pressure of the area, and then costs are also higher. And so this is the squeeze. This is the great squeeze that every healthcare professional really can feel sometimes. If you think about this great squeeze, how do you get out of it? Well, you could leave the area to go somewhere where there's less competition. Now, the thing is you don't have to do that. You can still make a good living. You can still make low six figures potentially as a physical therapist, even in an area that's really competitive. Now, the thing is you might have to work a bunch of hours to do that. You might have to spend more time away from your family than you really want to, but you can still live a decent lifestyle. You're not going to make a ton of money and drive a Range Rover or something like that and live in a five-bedroom house or something, but you can still have a reasonable lifestyle and enjoy your life. Now, if your goal is, hey, you know what? We want to make an easier lifestyle. We want to work fewer hours. We want to have just more opportunity to hang out with our family, but just have an easier path to profitability with less competition. Well, but then you might need to consider moving where the demand is and where the costs are low. So if you go to I'm not familiar with physical therapy in particular, what the market is, but if you go somewhere where there's not a lot of competition, your ability to say, I'm not going to take Medicaid, I'm not going to take low-paying insurance companies because my cost of service is actually higher than the revenues that I get, right? So I'm literally losing money on serving certain patients and I can't afford to lose money. So then you say, I'm going to accept cash only, or I'm going to accept high-paying insurance payments only. Well, now your reimbursement problem is a little better. And then the other thing is when you need to hire somebody for the front desk, or you need to hire help or something, or an assistant. Well, now maybe the people in the area don't have nearly as many opportunities for employment. And so you're able to get somebody that's really great for really a great bargain in terms of what you have to pay them per year. So I have a lot of sympathy for healthcare professionals that have the squeeze in income, partly because I experience it in my own personal life. My wife really likes big cities, urban areas, places that are terrible for salaries in terms of for healthcare professionals. She likes big employers, hospital kind of academic settings. And that's great for patients. It's great for a lot of things. It's one thing it's not great for is getting paid a lot. So that's what I would say as a business owner, is just decide what's important to you. And if you're okay feeling squeezed, then don't be stressed about things. And not everybody's intended to be a business owner. That's the other thing, is if you feel like this competition's doing you in mentally, physically, you're just so stressed all the time. Well, that's not worth making an extra $20,000 a year for. It's just not worth it. So if you decide, you know what, I would rather than try to fight things and try to paddle upstream, I'm just going to go work for the quote unquote man just to make my money and just relax and at least have a little bit less stress and have some PTO and be able to turn the lights off and go home. So there's no right or wrong answer. It's just basically what you want to do. The last question that this listener asked, do you think we'll get to a point where insurance bottoms out with their reimbursement, where like things like Medicaid that already doesn't pay enough per visit, therefore fewer and fewer medical providers that accept it, more providers have to transition to cash payments? If so, when, what does it happen? What does that do to the gap between the poor and wealthy in this country when providers cannot afford to treat poor patients while also keeping the business doors open? That is a fantastic question. There's no easy answer to that. You can increase provider payments and then people will see more patients and you won't have as many of the concerns about inequality there. But if they don't do that, then you're going to have rationing, because that's what happens. That's how any market responds to limited payments provided to people to provide a service, is you have a limited amount of people that are willing to provide that service. And so then you would see longer wait times for the poor and inequality would be worsened. I mean, that's just kind of exactly what would happen. The healthcare disparities in the system, right, with the difference between just healthcare provided to communities of color and richer communities, that's a great example of why that kind of stuff happens, is exactly what this listener mentioned. So I don't have the answers on that, but I know that, yes, if reimbursement rates go down, that poor communities of color will definitely suffer. But at the same time, I will say that don't try to feel responsible for solving all of society's problems on your own either. Don't blame yourself. Don't get stressed about this stuff. Just do the best you can. At the end of the day, if you serve patients at a loss, then you're not going to be able to stay in business. You won't be able to provide for your family, and you won't be able to consistently and sustainably provide service to these individuals. And maybe a large company, a large healthcare organization has ways of driving down costs in a way that makes it possible for them to see more Medicaid patients at a smaller profit margin, but maybe at volume. Maybe not, but I think that's one reason why you see certain kind of hospitals that are basically called safety net hospitals. Like when I used to be a bond trader, we would constantly talk about different hospital systems that we would invest in or not invest in. And some of the hospital systems were troubled hospitals from a financial perspective, right? They would consistently lose more money than they earned. And you might say, well, why would you invest in a hospital like that? Well, it's because that hospital would pretty much be the only option for a lot of people that needed treatment that couldn't afford it, right? And so you had consistent losses every year. And so the state government or federal government would often make extra kind of one-time lump sum payments to make these hospitals neutral or whole, just because of the importance of having some sort of safety net hospital where somewhere for people to go who don't have good insurance or don't have great coverage that pays a lot for reimbursement rates. It's a difficult question. I don't have a great answer on it. just don't get discouraged. Just realize that what's happening is you have unlimited student loans. Schools are responding to that by opening up a gazillion extra programs that probably shouldn't be open because the accreditation bodies care more about pushing a ton of new grads out with ever-increasing degree requirements so that they can get even wealthier and have an even bigger purview for their power, right? The accreditation bodies don't really care about you as the individual practitioner. They are responding to their incentives, which is to get as big as possible and to have as many advanced credentials as possible and get as much money as possible. Like, I went to Chicago on a weekend trip and I saw some, I won't mention the name, but there was like a national accreditation body for a graduate profession. And they had like a penthouse office with stunning views overlooking like Lake Michigan or something like that. And I thought, wow, how disgusting. Because if you think about it, there's zero reason why an accreditation body that is supposed to just be trying to provide quality instruction, make sure programs are pumping out quality candidates and everything, making sure curriculums are good. There's zero reason why they need to be in downtown Chicago with beautiful views overlooking some lake that costs way more money to rent that space. They do it because they can. And the people running these organizations sometimes are just responding to the things that get them paid the most money. In economics, when I was doing undergrad work, we would call that rent seekers. Rent seekers is kind of like a dirty word to an economist, but it sounds like something that's not, but we would always kind of joke, like in my economics club at college, that someone would, we would say, oh, that person's a rent seeker. In other words, it's just basically someone that's using their power and authority to get economic profits for themselves at the expense of others, right? And it's a very common behavior really at any level. Anyways, I know that's kind of a little bit of a soapbox, maybe more than you wanted, but I thought that would be really relevant to all of our listeners who are in the healthcare world, because I hear this kind of question or concern all the time. Hey, reimbursement rates are going down. My stress level is going up because my costs continue to go up. What am I supposed to do? And the simple answer is just to figure out what you can figure out, try to get things to a level where you feel comfortable, maybe cut back your lifestyle if you want to live in a specific area, maybe be comfortable not buying a house or living in a townhouse or something if the real estate market's really expensive because you get access to better amenities and so it's worth it to stay where you're at. Or you can go off and really try to go where the need is and really go where there's less competition. One great podcaster I listen to, Dr. Howard Ferran on Dentaltown, says, go where they ain't. But that's a great strategy for any healthcare professional to make a lot of money and have less stress. Is go where they ain't, meaning go where the providers are not, because you'll have a lot easier path to making it. And you'll probably see more and more concierge type folks. Some of our clients have mobile offices where they'll go anywhere where their really wealthy clients are because they all pay cash, right? So do your best, don't get discouraged, and remember that reimbursement rate cuts just mean that you have to adapt. That's why a lot of hospital systems are becoming so large and employing ever-increasing shares of the market for healthcare providers. It's just because when you have a very cost-limited market and you have a lot larger efforts with involvement by large organizations, maybe a lot more control in the market by the government as the client of paying for services and setting the prices for services, that becomes an environment where you have to control costs, which is best handled by really large organizations that have the power to negotiate down on things like labor, rent, payments for different things, and even power over negotiating what you pay for local and state income tax or things like that. Anyhow, thank you so much for the question. Let's talk a little bit about President Trump's finances. Again, the focus of what I'm going to talk about is not to talk specifically about his finances, but what kind of things did he do in his finances that you could maybe use to save some money on your student loans? Because I think it, regardless of whether you hate Trump or like Trump, I think that there's a lot of really interesting reporting the New York Times did that kind of made me think a little bit about how there's a lot of lessons in here for how to deal with debt, how to handle loans in your own life. Let's talk about this. One of the biggest questions that I get from readers and listeners is my forgiven student loan debt going to be taxable? Will I have to pay a ton of taxes on this? And is it going to just totally wreck my finances when my debt is forgiven? And that's a really wonderful question. It's a really scary question because that's one of the things that really dissuades people from using income-driven repayment plans and going for loan forgiveness is this fear that their debt is going to balloon and that it's going to soar and get huge. And then you're going to have to pay a big tax penalty. I just thought that I could say, you know, the debt will become huge, huge debt. Sorry, it's a joke. But anyways, that's a big fear that people are going to have really large debt and then they'll have to pay a massive tax penalty on that. So why do you have to pay a tax penalty right now under current IRS code when student debt is forgiven outside of the PSLF program? Because the PSLF program includes specific language that says forgiven debt will not be treated as taxable income, whereas the broader student loan programs do not list any information about the taxability of student loan debt. Therefore, the IRS code that says forgiven debt is taxable income dominates, and that's the reason why student debt is currently taxable outside of the PSLF program if it's forgiven. So how does this relate to Trump? The New York Times did a story on his Chicago Tower project and how he did not pay hardly anything in taxes on the $287 million of debt that he had forgiven on that tower. So a little background story. If you've ever been to Chicago, if you've ever taken one of the ferries along the river there, one of the architecture tours, I actually just did one a few months back when cases were a lot lower with my wife. It's pretty hard to miss this tower if you're in downtown Chicago. It's really, really large. And this was a project that they started in the mid-2000s and was completed around the financial crisis. So obviously, there was a lot of losses on this thing. There was defaults on the loans that Trump owed, and then he sued the lenders sued him. Basically, they came up with some sort of settlement, and a lot of this debt ended up being basically forgiven with terms that involved him having to continue to try to sell condos and rent space to try to pay back the lenders, etc. But usually, if you have forgiven debt, according to IRS code, it's taxable. And this is one of the things, one of the reasons why I think you should worry a little bit less about your forgiven student loan debt at some point, because of this very example of what Trump did when he faced with an ostensible $100 million tax bill for forgiven debt relating to his Chicago Tower project. So how did he get out of having to pay anything? Basically, what he did is take a lot of business losses from other places, and then he used it to apply against this income that he had from the forgiven debt from the tower. And so there's all kinds of financial crisis era tax stuff that got passed. Probably lobbyists kind of folks probably slipped this stuff in, and the people in Congress didn't read any of it and just signed it, right? Because it seems like that's the only way you could really get a lot of these things into code. But anyways, what he was able to do is take a bunch of losses from other things going on and apply it against this income from the forgiven debt. Does that mean he lost a ton of money? Actually, not necessarily. Anything in real estate is complicated. That's one thing that I've learned. That's one reason I try to stay out of it, because it's really, really complex, especially when you're dealing with very large real estate developments and everything. I personally just don't like it at all, because to have a really successful development, it seems, you almost have to be heavily involved in politics and really have a lot of relationships developed with local political leaders. The whole thing kind of feels icky to me. I guess that's just how developers do things. But locally here in St. Louis, right, and when I was in Philadelphia, there's always these weird sort of deals that are negotiated, and that kind of seems really like smoke-filled cigar rooms, right? So I don't know. But depreciation is something that has existed for a really long time. That's not exactly the thing that I'm talking about. Depreciation is kind of like when you build a big tower and you expect the useful life of that tower to be a certain number of years. And so you're able to take basically a portion of what you invested building the tower or the rental property or whatever, and you can depreciate it, meaning you can use part of what you invested, a percentage of that every year, to write off against your income to reduce your taxes. The reason that the tax code allows this is because it presumably gives owners the ability to save some money on taxes, which allows them to have money available to go and build a new tower when it needs to be knocked down, or renovate it when it's really old and needs to be made more updated. So there's, I guess, various reasons why this exists in the tax code. You could also say that a lot of developments have to pay property taxes where maybe other kinds of businesses don't. So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of arguments for this being fair and unfair. I'm not going to get into that part of things. I just think that what's interesting is think about what this means for you. I personally like to invest in index funds. I guess technically also my business is a huge source of investment. So for me, it's like mostly mutual funds and my business. I don't really have real estate stuff. But the thing is you might have a business, you might be interested in real estate. And if you're going to have a lot of forgiven student loan debt all at once, there are going to be ways with careful tax planning to try to reduce that lump sum income hit that you take. Now, it might not be easy, but I'm pretty confident there will be ways, if there is a tax bomb that's charged to you, for you to mitigate that hit that you would take on your income taxes. For example, let's say you're a dentist and you have all this income from forgiven student loan debt that happens all at once because you're on the pay-as-you-earn plan for 20 years. Kind of using this lesson that Trump applied to pay nothing on forgiven debt, you know, what if you decided that year to go out and purchase a second practice location? And maybe you talk to your accountant, you find some accelerated depreciation rules, or you find that if you invest a certain amount of money in expanding the office or something, that you can write most of that off against your income. Well, then you might be able to reduce that size of that income that you would earn from forgiven student loan debt that year. Maybe you decide, I want to go open up a real estate investment arm. There's something called professional real estate investor status, where if you or your spouse spend the majority of their time involved in real estate, then you can write off losses against your clinical income. That's another random bit of the tax code that I have no idea if it's going to be around in 20 years, but currently it exists, and I know some people that use it. And what they do is they basically will go and flip houses. They'll buy a house, fix it up. That generates a bunch of losses, even though it rises the value of their asset. So then they take all those losses and they can apply it against their clinical income. And I know a couple doctors who make a lot of money and who are able to use all these write-offs basically to pay very little in tax, which would also apply to forgiven debt from student loan forgiveness. This is really quite interesting. Think about it kind of like this. It's a tax dodge, but it's technically a legal tax dodge. Whenever you hear sports teams say that they don't make any money, they actually lose money. That's totally ridiculous. That's basically a lie, even though it's maybe technically truthful on paper. It's basically a lie. Why is that? It's because if I negotiate an amazing TV deal that's payable over 20 years or something, I might not get that cash today, but the value of my team because of that new negotiated TV deal is way, way higher than it was before. So I'm going to take the revenues of my team and invest them in player salaries, invest them in a nicer arena. A lot of times these sports teams will negotiate with local city councils that are really financially unsophisticated, and they will convince them somehow that they are losing money, which again, they basically figure out loopholes to make it look like they're losing money on paper, even though they have tons and tons of capital gains and the value of their team. That's how you kind of get all these tax dodges out there, right? Basically, as you can play with the numbers, and the smartest people from a financial standpoint tend to work for the business owners and tend to care the most, right? They're on the private sector side of the equation, and you have the public sector side of the equation where salaries are less funded, the biggest financial returns are working in the private sector. And so you have this habitual mismatch of ammunition, where is the city council's CPA going to have the same attention to detail and the same amount of caring as the owner of your local giant sports team that strong arms their way into tax cuts and less regulation? So I don't know. That's a little bit of a side comment. But the point is that you can figure out ways to not throw away money and not burn money. That's what really matters, right? While reducing your tax burden and investing in things you want to invest in, like your business or your real estate or something like that. So that's what I want to talk to you about, is don't be so scared about the forgiven student loan tax hit, because there will be ways to mitigate it, probably with a tax code if you pay for professional help, if the tax bomb is even owed at that time, which I don't necessarily think that it will be. Now, let's talk about the report in the New York Times that Trump said that they said that Trump paid only $750 of taxes, I think, in 2016. So again, this is playing with losses in the tax code. With depreciation, like I said, you can make it look like you have a loss, even though you don't. I'm not saying that was the case with Trump, but I'm saying if you have a property that there's some sort of law where you make a bunch of updates or you fix up a bunch of stuff and you generate a bunch of upfront losses. Say you have $10 million of repairs for the building and the building's value goes up by $50 million. Well, that's a net profit of $40 million, but on paper, you have a loss of $10 million. And that's very likely what he was able to do, because then you have that gain in the building. And then because of a section of the tax code called the 1031 exchange, you can take a property and exchange it into another property without having to pay any taxes on that capital gain. In other words, you just roll that capital gain into another building, basically. Now, I'm not a tax expert. I want to pretend that I understand all this stuff because it's very complicated. But in general, that's kind of what's going on. That's how he was able to pay almost nothing in taxes in that particular year, is because he was probably using depreciation and these carry forward losses to write off against any gains that he had. And then you can't just look at the income. You have to look at the phantom unclaimed income. So think about Jeff Bezos. Guy hasn't paid very much in taxes. The reason is because he's retained all the income inside of his corporation and found a bunch of places to spend that money to make it look like he has no profit while he's growing the value of his business enormously from capital gains, which are not taxed until they're realized. And it's very unlikely somebody like him is ever going to actually realize very much in the way of capital gains. That's kind of why you have some people like Senator Warren calling for wealth taxes, because it is very likely that the only way you actually would tax the ultra, ultra wealthy is through something like that. Again, I'm not saying that that's what we should or shouldn't do. I'm just saying that that's kind of where that argument's coming from. So how do you pay less in taxes? So maybe you don't care, which is fine. That's your right. But if you want to pay what you're legally required to pay and no more, that is something that I think is very reasonable. So how do you minimize your taxes? Well, one thing you can do is if you have phantom losses, kind of what we talked about with President Trump's finances, phantom losses that are not really losses, but on paper, they look like losses. Well, at a kind of a small timers, I guess you could say, like me and you, right, that are not gazillionaires, tax loss harvesting, you can basically have one mutual fund that's similar but not identical. And if you have a loss, you can sell it and buy another and then switch right back and generate a loss. And so you get $3,000 per year that you can use to write off against income that you get tax savings on from your ordinary income. That could easily be $1,200 to $1,500 in tax savings every year. And if you don't use all of that loss, you can carry it forward to future years. This is something that we actually talk about in our investing course that we offer once every 6 months for sign up. I think the next time we're going to offer it is in January. In addition to saving money with tax loss harvesting with your own personal investments, you can also save money on taxes with real estate. That's something that other people get into a lot more detail with than I do, just because I think that you really want to make sure you're listening to an expert on real estate if you're going to get involved with it. And I'm not an expert in real estate by any means. Another way to save money on taxes is thinking about your retirement plan savings. If you're an employee, you pretty much can do your 401k, and that's really about it. So your 401k is $19,500 per year max. That's what you can contribute as an employee. The good news is if you're a business owner, you can do way more than that. Sometimes you can set up a profit sharing plan where you can do maybe up to like $57,000 with like a solo 401k or something like that, depending on your earnings. And if you hire a fiduciary financial planner, like some of the ones, you know, that we've had on our show in the past, you can set up a self-employed person's personal pension plan, and then you can do as much as $200,000 in something like that, tax-free. Now, the problem is what are the complications of trying to save money on taxes? Well, there's not necessarily situations. There's some situations where you would actually want to pay more in taxes. There might be kind of a lot of catches to things. So for example, with that defined benefit plan where you can put away 200 grand a year that I talked about, that could force you to contribute to that for a long time when you really don't want to do that. Maybe you want to use the money for something else. Maybe you decide to sell your business. Maybe you decide to work fewer hours or something. There's all kinds of things where you don't want to necessarily go out and do something just because of the tax benefits. It needs to be something that matches with the lifestyle that you want to have. Now, for example, me personally, I switched from a sole proprietorship to an S corporation once. That switch, that tax savings, is something a lot of dentists and medical professionals that own their own practices end up doing. And the reason is this is something that actually President-elect Biden actually did. He had, I think, a book and speaking engagements and everything. And so he set up a corporation, or really probably his CPA did it. Because what he did is he pays himself a salary so he can take the rest of the profits as a distribution of dividends. And the reason why that is because Medicare tax is 2.9% of everything. So it's 2.9% of all of your earnings, all of your wages. But when you set up a corporation, you can pay yourself a salary, let's say $120,000, and distribute all the rest of it as a dividend, which allows you to avoid Medicare tax. And so that's why President Biden did it. That's why most of our clients that set up S corporations do it at the recommendation of their CPA. It's not because you are trying to do something legal. It's literally allowed in the tax code. And it's something that most people, including the new president-elect, have done. Now, you could say, well, these kind of really complicated tax maneuvers are something totally different. Well, sure, maybe they are, but I think, again, I just wanted to talk about this, not necessarily from a political perspective, but just how there's stuff out there that's being reported by, you know, the New York Times, that I think is kind of interesting. You can make analogies to student loans and have an interesting new way to think about how to manage student loans. Another example of like when saving money on taxes might not be everything. So my CPA mentioned once that, hey, maybe you should consider changing to a different type of corporation. And the thing is if I did that, then maybe I would have to pay taxes twice. And why is that? Well, if I want to actually use the money for hitting financial independence or being able to spend money on certain things, then you have to pay tax on the corporate level first. And then again, you have to pay taxes when you pull it out. Well, if taxes are at what they are now or higher than when I pull that money out to actually use it, I might end up actually paying more tax, a lot more tax, than if I just pay a tax on basically everything right now, right? So it's kind of interesting. Don't focus on paying as little in taxes as possible and have that be your only concern. But do everything you can to reduce your tax burden and take advantage of things like when you're a business owner, it's just way, way better. The tax code loves business owners that have profits and make investments in the economy. That's really what the tax code rewards a lot. And again, maybe it rewards it too much. I don't know. I'm not going to take a position on that, but I'm going to say that you will be able to do a lot just by paying a little bit of attention on your taxes and just trying to ask the right questions and learn a little bit and then let the professionals take it the rest of the way, right? It's kind of like being an informed consumer. If you're getting a surgery, you don't need to know how to be a brain surgeon, but it's probably pretty good to at least understand a little bit, right? So you know how to ask intelligent questions. One more thing, actually two more things that I want to talk about. Remember the discussion of, I think it was like the NBC interview with Samantha Guthrie. Trump was really pressed on this like $400 million of debt that he has, that the New York Times reported. I have no idea what the terms of that debt is or what the amount is or who it's owed to, et cetera. But think about this. In terms of your student loans, what matters is your net worth. So one kind of interesting thing is it's asset minus debt that is what matters. President Trump has oftentimes stated a value of his assets that it's very likely way more than he actually has. A lot of it depends on the value of hard-to-value buildings and big properties. This year, with coronavirus, probably a lot of his properties are worth a lot less just because of the dynamics we're seeing with New York City real estate being way down, big city real estate being way down, real estate in the suburbs and such being more expensive and more sought after. But at the end of the day, if you have say he has a $2 billion amount of assets and $400 million of debt, then $2 billion minus $400 million is $1.6 billion. That's really, really a lot of money. Think about it just at the micro level for your situation. What if you have $400,000 of student debt, but you have $2 million of assets? Then your net worth would be $1.6 million and you would be in the wealthiest, probably 1 to 5% of Americans. I'm not exactly sure where that would put you, but you would be a millionaire. People so often think the only way to be rich is to have zero debt. That's not the case. What you have to do is have a significant amount of assets. For your own personal situation, what you need is to get to net worth zero. The best, fastest way to get there is by having a high savings rate and by earning as much as you can without doing a lifestyle or living a lifestyle you don't want to live. In other words, don't work 70 hours a week and never see your children. But maybe think about side hustles. Maybe think about moving to a place where you get paid a higher rate of reimbursement that we talked about earlier in the show. Maybe consider some way to reduce your costs for your business so you can have more profit that way without having to necessarily see more patients. There's all kinds of things you can do to increase your earnings power and then to increase the amount that you save. And then you take that and you invest it in whatever you want, retirement money, brokerage accounts. We talk a lot about some people like real estate. Some people like to invest even more in their own businesses, maybe buy a second practice location or even buy multiple practice locations, or maybe just build out a giant location yourself for a mega practice or something like that. But remember that the difference with student loans and other kinds of debt is, say you take out $1 million practice loan to buy a practice. Well, your net worth didn't drop by $1 million. Right? What happened is you had $1 million asset that's minus $1 million of debt. And so the net worth change that you experienced there was zero. And let's say you increase the revenues of this practice that you now own. Well, maybe in a few years, maybe your practice is worth $1.5 million, maybe you've paid down some of the debt to say $800,000 or something. Well, now you have a positive equity of that business of $700,000 minus any commissions. If you sold it, maybe it's less than that, but that's how you get wealthy over time, is increase your assets at a faster rate than you increase your debt. And it doesn't matter if your debt grows and grows and grows, as long as your assets grow faster. So that's the really key thing to keep in mind, is you really want to focus on having your assets grow faster than your debt. If you do that, everything's going to work out great. So just make sure you think about that. Now, the last point is the terms of your debt. So the $400 million of debt that President Trump had, if he has assets well in excess of that with the financial situation and economy that's not bad, then he probably would be able to easily refinance that debt into other terms that would not really pose any problems in terms of risk to his personal finances. What that means is, what matters on debt is, what are the terms and are you liquid when you have a financial event happen? Say the economy is 2008 style, puts him in a tight spot. The concern there was he could be influenced by somebody who's willing to give him the loan when he had to make the payment and he maybe wouldn't be able to refinance. So it's one of those things where, for your situation, what about your liquidity? Is your liquidity good? Could you make payments on something that you owe without having to take a mortgage out on your house or a mortgage out on your practice? Because taking out a big loan on something that you own may or may not be possible if the economy is in bad shape, whereas you might have to pay that big income tax hit regardless. You want to have at least some amount of money that's available to you, some amount of money that's available and liquid. And what matters is the terms of the debt that you take out. Your terms of your student loans are listed in your promissory note. You're able to have all kinds of benefits as a student loan borrower, like forgiveness of debt due to death or disability, tax-free. The likelihood, based off of politician statements, that there will not be taxes collected on the forgiven debt, even though that's what the current state is. Likelihood that we will see changes in repayment terms that will probably keep what they have today or even make it better. Again, the terms of your student loan debt are not nearly as bad as other kinds of debt. And with all the discussion about student debt cancellation, this is a political debt versus a financial debt that's owned by a bank. That means that as a voter, you have a lot less to worry about with that debt being owned by the federal government than you do if it's owned by a private bank. Now, on the flip side, if you're making a lot of money, but you're planning to make a lot more than what you earn or what you have on the debt long term, then you probably don't want that to be a politically owned debt, because then you're getting charged a higher interest rate that's really more than your credit risk and you should refinance with a private lender. So think a lot about that. We're going to have a lot more content for you as we get more certainty on the makeup of the Senate, as we get certainty over who President Biden's Secretary of Education is going to be and what that might signify with student loans. Obviously, we'll talk a lot about the end to the payment and interest pause and whether or not that'll be extended and what that extension would look like when and if it happens. And also, don't forget, you can ask questions. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Please feel free to ask any questions that are on your mind, because we'd love to cover them in an upcoming show. Hopefully, that was kind of a fun episode to go into details. Again, I thought it would just be fun to look through this New York Times report and try to pick out things, just because it's in current events, that could apply to your life and try to make your management of your student loan debt a little bit better. Again, if you need help managing it or figuring out a plan, we'd love to help you. studentloanplanner.com/help. Thank you and have a wonderful week.